Okay, this is tape three, side one, Gus Schubert interview, July 17, 1992. Let me just throw out a couple of questions for you to consider, and you can decide whether you want to fit them in now or as you're talking about the New York thing. I'm just wondering, for the domestic division, whether they had any special kind of relationship with the Washington office as you developed the program in the same way that the national security side of RAND did, and whether your patterns of working with universities and academics in universities were similar to what had transpired and had been established on the national security side of the house.
Well, with regard to the second question first, if anything, our interactions with universities were more frequent and more intense. In my view, than those on the national security side were at the time. And since then, that trend has continued. That is to say, there's been an increasing gap between the two sides of the house in the way they relate to universities. The one thing that tries to hold them together, and with some success, is the RAND Graduate School and Charlie Wolf's efforts. He's really been very, very good about that. He tries to bridge the gap himself. He's running an enterprise which trains people for analytical roles in both areas, and he tries very hard to maintain relations with universities in both areas. But on the domestic side, as I say, it's the typical reaction is that of a worker who will turn first for peer review to an academician on the outside, whereas, I don't mean to be unkind, but typically because of the pressures of time or the internal bureaucracy, the typical researcher on the national security side will not perceive enough value being added by a review process, so he'll try to avoid it altogether, using the working draft as a reporting mechanism, or using a briefing as a mechanism. And unfortunately, while it was true in the earlier days of RAND's history that every briefing was thoroughly reviewed before it went out of the house, that is no longer the case. And I would guess that the number of briefings that are thoroughly reviewed is 15%, perhaps. And there have been briefings that have gone out, I'm sorry to say, containing major errors, technical briefings, not social science briefings where nobody will ever know the difference or care if there is a difference, but technical briefings where the math has been done wrong, that have gone out and been presented to audiences, and then somehow accidentally given in RAND, or written up as working drafts or something, and have been seen by experts in the field who say, wait a minute, this is all wrong. All the equations are wrong, it's the wrong approach to the problem, and besides, they can't even do the arithmetic right. So there is value to the review process. The trick is to get people to perceive the incentive in it when they are competing against all these other pressures, which we did not used to have. That's part of this big difference that has emerged in our discussion today. I mean, back in the bad old days, there were no deadlines, really, except those that were self-imposed. And if they were self-imposed, they were typically self-imposed for professional reasons. And therefore, it was perceived by the researcher to be in his interest, by and large. You know, everybody has a little bit of paranoia, but most people can control it, and they would seek out criticisms of their work before they launched it into the outside world. That takes time. It takes thought. It takes... And those have become luxury commodities at RAND now. people are just working flat out, especially on the domestic side. The biggest concern on the domestic side now, as I have detected it in the past month by talking with the principal domestic groups, is that they're going to get levied on them from on high tasks that they're not competent to do. They're working so hard at what they're doing, and they know that the front office has in mind big, new, important projects, and they know that one of these days, out of the blue, the top is going to lay it on them, and they know they can't do it, and that's their major concern, and they don't have the luxury of going out and recruiting to do it, and that's also aggravated by a lack of what's perceived at the department level as a lack of communication with management, so that they don't know what's going to come and hit them next. That's a source of considerable anxiety on the part of the people who are working too hard. On the part of the people whom the Russians are threatening to put out of business, that's a different set of issues. So I've urged, and Jim is now establishing, an advisory group reporting to him and to him only, composed of one national security and one domestic researcher from each of our, they're not called departments anymore, but they're essentially departments, and no bureaucrats, apparatchiks, or other wheels. This is just pure working stiffs who will have regularly scheduled meetings with Jim to talk about what their problems are and how they see the institution evolving and where it ought to be going and that sort of thing. It hasn't existed up to now. So it used to be done informally, but now the last couple of years it really hasn't happened at all.
Did you have consultant relationships with people in the university community? Is that one way that you kept them interested and involved in what you were doing? And
sure. We still have, 300 academic consultants out there, and we have many more people we can call on who are, I think, no longer consultants but once were, so that very helpful in recruiting, very helpful in refereeing. When we did our alcoholism study, the first study, I think that study had over 100 reviews, with most of them being done by people outside RAND and most of those being done by academics active in that field. None of them consultants to RAND. People we just went out and got to review this work because it was so controversial. So we do make a lot of use of that community.
The other part of my question was about interaction with the Washington office.
When we established the division, when we got far enough along to know that we were going to be doing enough to have a division, I had a group in the Washington office who were concerned with domestic research. They were not a sales office or anything like that. They fell into two types. One was researchers involved in working on projects who just damn well wanted to be in Washington. And we couldn't entice them to come to California. And they were so good that we wanted to, that we caved. Our general policy is you go where we say. And what we say is RAND is in Santa Monica, and that's where we want you. That's been, by and large, the rule, obviously violated by New York and to some extent by Washington. So there was a group of domestic researchers there who were there because they wanted to be there, and it had little, if anything, to do with their research. There was another group that was there because of the need to operate close in with the client. And that, in particular, was the housing group, where the operational part of the program was headquartered in Washington, and the overall project director was resident in Washington. And the field operations people were resident in Washington. And then over those two groups, I established a position for a deputy to me to sort of oversee their work, to help them, to give them visibility, and so on and so forth. And Barbara Williams was that person and did a terrific job at it. Now there is really no parallel development. I mean, no parallel arrangement. There are domestic people in Washington. They're doing domestic things. They're certainly more of the first type. That is, they're there because they want to be than for any substantive reason. There is no deputy vice president in Washington overseeing that work. There's one very senior person there who is often a source of guidance and consultation, but that's all unofficial. That's Tom Glennon, who is Keith Glennon's son.
Right, right.
He's just an invaluable person to have around. Incidentally, I don't mean to imply that the national security thing is a sales operation either. But it is much more of a liaison operation than it is a substantive operation. And that's evolved from an arrangement where it was almost exclusively substantive. And in fact, when the Social Science Department was created, it was located in Washington.
Right.
And then moved out to Santa Monica, sort of en masse. I've forgotten when, but a couple of years after it was established.
Actually, through most of the 50s, the core of the social scientists were
that's probably right.
In Washington. Well, I'd be ready to initiate discussion of the New York activity and how that came about, if you want to move on to that.
Okay.
The best I can tell from just little bits and pieces that I've looked at is that discussions about having some kind of collaboration between RAND and the city of New York started in 1967. So if you could just sort of elaborate your understanding of the beginnings of that and how it evolved to the establishment of an institute.
They started in, I think that's right, about in 1967. They were sort of conducted in parallel with the thought, you know, this is all post the arrival of Roman. And although he started the domestic talks, the RAND domestic capability talks, to the best of my understanding, it was John Lindsay in New York who started the New York talks, not RAND. And we were approached by Lindsay and his emissaries to help him with some of the problems of the city. Now, this wasn't something that was full-blown in the forehead of John V. Lindsay, I can assure you. His budget director at that time was a fellow named Frederick O'Reilly Hayes, who served in that capacity for some years. He subsequently went on to Massachusetts, where he became the director, I think, the director of human resources policy for the state. And since then, I've lost track of him. I don't know what he's doing. I remember he shared with me his ambition to become secretary of ATW, and he didn't make that yet, so I guess he never will. But that was his orientation. And as budget director of New York, I can sort of picture him walking into his office, looking around and saying, "Holy cow, this is unbelievable. Nothing works right around here. And a lot of these problems are the kinds of problems that are analyzable." And so he began to think, and he began to talk with various people about who would be the right institution to help. And as I understand it, he started the conversation by saying, and let's not hear about Rand. I don't want Rand in on this. Why he said that, I don't know. And if he said that, I'm not sure. But that's the story that I've been told, not by him. Because he did his survey of organizations and came in and recommended to Lindsay that Rand be approached. And they then, I think probably before approaching us, cooked up the way in which this was going to be supported by the city. What they had in mind was a Rand office in New York. The Rand office would do work for each of several operating agencies, police, fire, housing, health, welfare, or human resources as it became later on, corrections. And you'll notice that virtually all of those are amenable to sort of traditional Rand quantitative analysis. Now the question was, who's going to pay for this? And there were obviously at least two options, a centralized option, I suppose three, a centralized option, a decentralized option in which the agency paid for what it got, and a sharing option. And Fred, in his wisdom, decided that the agencies would pay for this work. Well, as a member of a bureaucracy yourself, you know the delight with which bureaucratic agencies respond to externally imposed requirements to spend money, and not only to spend money, but to listen to advice. So Fred also knew that, Fred being a very canny character. So again, I wasn't there. I don't know this at first hand, but my understanding is that the way the city was approached was through the Budget Bureau. The way the agencies were approached was through the Budget Bureau. And not to decorate it too much, they were approached with the following choice. We're talking about bringing Rand here to work on problems of your department. You can agree to work with Rand, and your budget will be augmented by the money we see fit to allocate for you to spend on Rand. You're also perfectly free to refuse to work with Rand, in which case your budget will be decreased by the amount we would have given you in order to enable you to work with Rand. You might say we were leveraged into position by the central management. And in fact, what happened was that the agencies who craved more than anything increased money and power saw it in their interest to amass these additional resources. So the ones that were approached agreed to work with Rand. So that's the deal that was worked out. And it was worked out, Rand principals there were once again Ed Huddleston, Harry Rowan. I was in on some of it, but there wasn't an awful lot to do. The question was whom to get to head it. We got Peter Zanton, who was well known to Fred Hayes. Peter is an historian. He's not a research person, per se. But we thought that it would be well within his capability to manage this kind of an activity. And then we set about staffing each of the projects which were not projects, each of the areas which were predetermined by the agencies with which we were going to work. And they were, as I said, police, fire, health, housing, corrections, and welfare. I think those were the six where we started out. The agreement was that we would have a relatively free rein within the constraints of the functional area. That is, the police department wasn't going to pay for work for the fire department or for housing. And that was a bane. That was one of the banes of our existence, because getting cross-cutting work started proved to be impossible. Just couldn't do it. But within those limits, we were pretty free to select the areas that we wanted to work on, typically with the agreement of the head of the relevant agency. So that in the fire department, we always started by looking for what are the big problems. And with the fire department, the big problems were that the system was about to crash. This was in the period when false alarm rates were skyrocketing. The city responded to every alarm with a standard response, one ladder and two bumpers, no matter what the alarm was, where it came from, so on and so forth. And we thought that was an important area to look at, because we predicted, fearlessly predicted, that their main dispatching center in Brooklyn was going to be overwhelmed and would, in fact, become dysfunctional within 6 months. So the fire department said, okay, you can work in that area if you want to. Not that it's very important, and not that you guys can do anything, because you don't know anything about fire, which was true. We didn't know anything about fire. And one of the reasons for the great success of that project was that we were always appropriately modest about what we knew of the substance. And we were always willing to work with the fire people to work with their substance and our methods. And that was very, very successful. The opposite occurred with the police, where our project leader was a man who was a mistake. His selection was a mistake. He was a man who knew everything about everything. And his approach to the police department was, when are you jerks going to stop goofing off and start solving the crime problem around here? I'm here to tell you how to do it. Well, you can imagine the reception that that got. We agreed on a couple of projects. The fact that the first one demonstrated to the satisfaction of at least of every academic and police expert in the United States that detectives, whatever it is they do, don't detect. They don't solve crimes. Helped also to get us off to a good, sweet relationship with the police department. So each of these problems was typically broken down into several different projects. There was an overall leader for each area who worked with teams within the area and conducted liaison as necessary with the department. The city made a very, very important agreement at the beginning, and that was that you will not get results from this kind of work overnight. That the city had to have patience. And I have to say, this is one of the few areas in which they were, in fact, true to their word. They did not push when we didn't have anything to offer. And they saw how hard we were working. They knew that something was going to come out of it. And they gave us elbow room, and they gave us time. In every dimension except the political dimension, where when it was agreed between Rand and the mayor's office that we would open a New York office and we would work on these problems, it then became very clear that John Lindsay was going to use this as a political device. And when I arrived in New York, I was greeted by the New York Daily News with a great big headline that said, Rand here to save city, Mayor SEZ. And I knew right then we were off on the right political foot, that we were building a constituency like nobody's business. But in spite of that, we went ahead. We tried to keep a very low profile. In fact, if Zanton underestimated anything, it was the importance of maintaining some kind of constructive public affairs, public information function. He wouldn't talk to anybody about anything and wouldn't spend a penny on advice or press releases or communicating. And consequently, his profile was so low that when something went wrong, there was nothing to fall back upon. We had no constituency, no alliance, no nothing. And I think that was a serious, I think Peter would agree that was a serious error.
How many RAND people were sitting here in New York once
the
office
was
established?
We started, you know, with a very small group at first, and then it grew to 15 or 20, and I think at its peak there were perhaps as many as 60 professionals there. So it was a big, big effort. And it was successful enough in the course of the first year or so that the mayor, politician as always, saw this RAND office in there doing all these things and getting all this credit, and he said, I want a piece of this action. And he turned to either Fred or Ed Hamilton, I've forgotten who, saying, I want you to create something out of this so I get the credit. And what came out of that was the New York City RAND Institute. The New York City RAND Institute, and here, once again, Huddleston and Gaither were instrumental in devising the legal forms, just as they were in the housing project with the offices that we set up in the field, just as they were in the health project and how we conducted our field operations. They were just crucial in helping us make suitable arrangements. The New York City RAND Institute was a joint venture membership corporation with two members, initially the City of New York and RAND. RAND goes in for these kind of unequal rabbit stew kind of relationships, where in another one now, which perhaps we'll touch on. The actual members were the mayor of the City of New York or his representative, and the president of RAND or his representative. And initially, Harry was the RAND member, and I guess Hayes was the city member. Those two people jointly chose a board of trustees, which I guess was about 20. And they were, by and large, prominent New Yorkers, not from the bureaucracy, but prominent citizens with concern for the city and some demonstrated capability of dealing with them or recognizing them or whatever. Some of them were academics. Jackie Wexler was on the board. She was president, of Hunter at the time. Lou Thomas from Rockefeller University was on the board. And the chairman of the board, the first chairman of the board, was a retired judge named Bernard Botin. And this was an operation in which I don't think there was ever a single disagreement, no matter who the RAND member was or who the city member was, on the appointment of members of the board. We agreed on who the bums were, and we agreed on who the good people were, and if there was a RAND vacancy on the board and the city wanted to put X on the board, there was never any reason not to do so. And the reverse was also true. So we very often just traded posts. That was an area of great amicability. The work went on as it developed. Some of it got increasingly good. Some of it was overtaken by perils. I guess though that covers the range. What I mean by overtaken by perils was our work with the police department. This was the era of the Knapp Commission.
Right.
There were investigations of corruption in the department. The police chief, with some cause, although perhaps not due cause, hated our guts, wanted us out of there, not only because the project leader was a pain in the rear end, but also because we had data on the police department that nobody else had. We had the complete records of the careers of the police academy class of 1958. We had their school records, we had their selection records, their school records, their grades, their disciplinary records, their evaluations as they were promoted or not promoted, nefarious and heroic activities in which they were involved. We had that whole file. And that was one thing that the police chief commissioner was not eager to see us have. It had been given to us before he knew about it. And once it was in our possession, we wouldn't give it back. We did promise, however, to sanitize it so that no individual could be identified from the file. And that, I assume Zanton gave that pledge. And it was after Zanton quit and I became president of the place on a commuting basis that the Knapp Commission hearings were nearing a crescendo. And one day the guy who was working on that particular file and that particular project came into me and said, "Now, you know," he says, "the Knapp hearings are going on," he says, "and, you know, so-and-so is doing, spilling all the beans." He says, "I think you ought to know he is a rotten apple." And I said to him, "I can understand you're wanting me to know, but how do you know?" And it turns out that he'd never deleted the identifiers from the file. So I had to go back and oversee, literally sit in his office while the records were cleaned up and the identifiers were removed. This guy was one of the people we had recruited in New York, and an amiable fellow, but one who loved gossip better than almost anything. One thing he liked better was, given his training as a sociologist, was drawing curves using single-point estimates, which gave us some awfully misleading conclusions. So it's a good thing we had a strong review process there.
What was the nature of this particular study with the police department?
This was it was essentially a database, which we were free to use for any purpose that we wanted to. We used it, for example, to advise the department on promotion policy, selection criteria for promotion. We used it as a basis for an analysis of affirmative action in the police department. We used it as the basis for an analysis of racial discrimination in the police department. So it was a sort of a general utility file regarding the human resources of the department, which I found extremely useful. Other things we did for them, outstanding things that spring to my mind, which I would count as achievements before we got fired, were patrol car allocation analysis. They had no way of allocating except, you know, 3-shift day, 8 hours a shift, more in the day, less at night, of course, when there's more crime. They had no patrol car allocation models. They had no method except seat-of-the-pants methods for doing this. We developed methods that have not only been used there, but they've been used in many, many other American cities on to help with the allocation of that kind of resource. That led us into the area which I think was probably with the police our greatest success, which was to convince them that they should develop some method of allocating their physical and human resources in such a way that there was some match between those resources and the place and rate of crime. And that was a thought that had not occurred to them. And as it turned out, it would happen to be against the law. The law was fixed, and the law specified 3 8-hour shifts daily. It specified them by size, by location, by everything else. And furthermore, this was not a city law. It was a state law. So the fire department immediately, when we raised that problem, says, you know, no chance. There ought to be a law, and there is. So we came up with the concept of a fourth platoon, which would be essentially a variation according to crime rate, location of crime. It's kind of, you know, it's like almost like an electricity demand model, time sensitive, demand sensitive, and all that kind of thing. And we tested it, demonstrated to our satisfaction it would work, and the mayor sent an expedition up to Albany and got it approved, and a fourth platoon was created, and I think it considerably enhanced the effectiveness of the police department. We very early on in the game, before we really knew what it was all about, we became aware of a major problem called cooping. Cooping in New York is taking your cruiser and going off to a nice secluded spot and having a snooze of up to several hours duration, for which period of time you are out of action and nobody knows where you are or what you are doing, which gave, of course, all kinds of opportunities for other kinds of activities. So we naively said, well, there ought to be an easy way of dealing with this. And we developed, it's one piece of technology, one of the few pieces of technology we developed in New York. We developed a very low-cost, very reliable car locator system so that the police headquarters could know where every car was every minute of every day. And we walked into the police headquarters with these big smiles on our face saying, we got something for you. And they took one look at that and threw up their hands in absolute horror and said, you were never here. We don't want that. Why would we want to know that? We don't want to know where our cars are. If we know where they are, then we're going to have to keep track of them. We're going to have to get involved in all kinds of things that would be better off not knowing. Get out of here. So that was never implemented by the police department. In fire, our prediction about the breakdown of the dispatch center turned out to be accurate. And we did not run off to the newspapers and tell them what a bunch of asses the fire department were. We just kept quiet and said, you know, we're here, we can help. Since they had developed some trust in us, partly out of pure luck and partly because we didn't run to the newspapers, the pure luck being a fire chief asked a RAND researcher, how many alarms will we have 6 months from now on, you know, the 17th of January 1993? And he took out an envelope from his pocket, and he took out a pencil, and he said, pop, 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 and the time period expired, and he was within 2%. So that tended to build, that was sheer luck, and it just tended to build up, it built up the relationship.
Correct the 3 decimal points.
Almost. It was unbelievable. Unbelievably lucky. So the fire department said, okay, you develop a solution for the Brooklyn dispatching problem, and we'll develop a solution, and we'll compare them. And we developed one that involved, I think, either the same or a smaller number of personnel, less expenditure on technology, but a reorganization of the entire activity. They came up with one, of course, that called for more equipment, more men, more money. And we said it wouldn't work. They, of course, said ours wouldn't work. but they still had enough faith into us to put in us to put the two into operation in tandem. And within 3 weeks, theirs had failed, and ours was working like a watch, like a Timex. And they said, you know, maybe these guys really have something. We ought to listen to them more. So that when we developed a method of distinguishing false alarms with a high probability of being correct from real alarms, and then of distinguishing among real alarms different types of alarms, street fires, trash fires, serious dwelling fires, not serious dwelling fires. We had a whole typology of the possibility, and we could assign probabilities, and then we said to them, this is not 1890. The horses are gone from in front of the pumpers. You can vary your response. And if you get something that shows up with a 0.9 probability of being a false alarm, just send out a car and have a look. On the other hand, if you get an indication of a 0.9 reliability prediction of a serious dwelling fire with human lives at stake, you can send out more than your typical response. And with great reluctance, they bought that, and it worked. And they were very, very happy with it, especially when the chief could stand up and say, I, John T. O'Hagan, chief of department of the New York City Fire Department, have invented a new way, and so on. The word RAND was never used, and we never raised it. And I guess there's one other thing which is worth talking about, and that's technological in nature, and that was the development of a thing called slippery water. The head of the project, just coincidentally, was a chemical engineer as well as an OR type. And one morning while he was showering, he kind of looked at the water coming out of the shower, and he said, you know, if I added long chain polymers to the intake side of this shower, I could get twice as much water out of the shower, or I could get a shower half this size and get the same amount of water, because it would reduce the turbulence of the boundary layer and so on and so forth. So he came into RAND, came into the office, which was at 55th and Madison, and did a few calculations, and lo and behold, he demonstrated to his own satisfaction that he was right. And he went out and he talked to Union Carbide, which was just down the street from us, and they had the only material commercially available which would do the trick. Incidentally, it's also added to beer. It keeps the head up in your beer, so you're drinking a certain amount of slippery water when you drink a beer. And we got them to agree to provide some of this material, and we ran some tests. And sure enough, the fire department was presented with a choice. They could keep the same hoses that they have, which are very bulky, very, very heavy, and double the amount of water they will deliver by adding, through a special device, the original of which I have sitting in my office in Santa Monica. It's a gigantic hopper, and you just throw the stuff in, approximating quantities and so on. It would go in on the intake side of the pump, mix with the water, and then go out the other side very smoothly. And sure enough, it worked. It worked like a charm. Or you could reduce the hoses, the size and weight of the hoses, by 50%. And get the same volume you were getting out of these great big houses, which is, of course, important if you're dragging a hose up to the 98th story of the Empire State Building. So you would think that would be the end of a great success story. Well, of course, what ensued was the following. We said to O'Hagan, you know, now, there are obvious manpower implications.
Let me just switch the tape over here.